Welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast. This podcast features a session from the EDUCAUSE Learning Initiative 2011 annual meeting. The speaker is Eric Mazur, professor of physics and applied physics and dean of applied physics at Harvard University. His session is entitled Using Technology to Engage Students.
Thank you, Malcolm, for that kind introduction. In her opening remarks, Diana Oblinger said that the EDUCAUSE ELI Learning Initiative had made the transition from being about technology to being about deep learning. Well, I'm here to tell you about my transition from being all about teaching to being all about learning. There's an uncanny parallel about those two messages. In fact, the bottom line message, that it's not just about technology, but it's about the pedagogy behind the technology, is also a message that I am going to try to reinforce in the next 50 minutes or so. When I started teaching at Harvard in 1984 as a young assistant professor, that picture that should be on the screen shows my classroom in the mid-80s. I'm still young. I'm no longer an assistant professor. I never asked myself how I was going to teach. It was totally obvious to me how I was going to teach. I was going to do to my students what my instructor had done to me. In fact, I took that decision completely unconsciously. It was something totally natural to me. After all, I had learned physics and other things that way. So clearly that was the way that one taught and learned new material. And to make matters worse, very quickly I was receiving feedback that I was doing the right thing in my classroom. Incidentally, as an assistant professor at Harvard, I was asked to teach the course that absolutely no one wanted to teach, namely physics for pre-medical students. None of the students were there because they wanted to learn physics. It was a completely captive audience. They were there because they had to learn physics. Anyway, in spite of that not very positive premise, the feedback that I received was very positive. I got very high evaluations at the end of the semester, 4.5, 4.3 on a 5-point scale. Most of my colleagues, when they saw the end of semester evaluation for that course, if they had taught it, would come close to committing suicide. But not so for me. I got high ratings, so clearly the students liked what I was doing. In addition, I could give my students some problems that I considered really difficult, and they would generally do well on the exams. So, obviously, I was doing the right thing. And for a number of years, that wonderful illusion of being a good teacher continued. Until I read, some 6 or 7 years later, I think it was 1990, I read about an instrument that is used now nationwide. Some of you may know about it. It's called the Force Concept Inventory, an instrument to measure students' conceptual understanding of forces. Now, in physics, the curriculum starts with describing motion, then you describe forces, and then everything else builds on top of those two building blocks. If you do not understand forces, there's no sense in trying to understand anything else in physics. Let me give you an example from the Force Concept Inventory so you have an idea for the type of questions on it, because I'll show you some data later on. A heavy truck and a light car collide head-on on the highway. The force exerted by the heavy truck on the light car is A, larger than that of the light car on the heavy truck. B, they're equal to each other in magnitude. C, the light car exerts a larger force on the heavy truck than the other way around. D, they're not exerting any force on each other. They are just in each other's way. Now, some of you are laughing. I don't think anybody could ever come up, any physicist at least, could ever come up with such an answer. The power of the FCI, however, is that it's constructed by answers, common misconceptions that students give. Professor Hestenes at Arizona State University, the author of this test, developed it by asking these questions as free response questions and tabulating the most frequent incorrect responses, and this was one of them. Now, the great thing about the FCI is you don't need to have studied physics to answer those questions. Well, you have to have studied physics to answer them correctly, perhaps, but you can read and understand what the question means without having had physics. I'm sure that in the audience here we have many people who have never had any physics course, and as I was enumerating the answers, you probably in your mind already chose what you think is the most likely correct answer. It doesn't involve any jargon. Yes, it has the word force in it, but we all grow up developing some mental concept of that word force. So the great thing you can do with that FCI is you can give it before physics instruction at the beginning of a course and then repeat it at the end to see how effective the education was. And one of the things that Hestenis showed back in the late 80s was that most, if not all, introductory physics courses yielded virtually no gain on this FCI. In other words, it doesn't matter whether you ask the questions at the beginning of the term or the end of the term, you get the same wrong responses. Well, as I'll show you, there's a minimal gain, but it's not very high. In addition, he showed that there was no correlation between the end of semester evaluation and the performance of the students. Award-winning teachers got the same gain on the FCI as teachers who scored so low that, you know, they'd be fired by the dean. Well, I read this, and, you know, most of the students who take pre-med physics courses at Harvard have already taken an advanced placement course, so they've already had a full year of physics. I was basically steaming through the chapters on Newtonian mechanics and forces because I considered it just a quick review. After all, I had learned this in high school, and most of my students had learned it in high school. So I thought, you know, this is not of any relevance to what is happening in my class. But then I thought about it some more, especially when I saw the statistics about the award-winning teachers, and I thought for a moment, you know, maybe this is some... The schools that had been tested by Hestenis were all in Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, California. So I thought maybe this is some disease that rages on the West Coast. Up in the Northeast, we're sure to do a lot better. But then, you know, I was educated as a scientist. You learn not to make assertions without actually proving it. So I thought I better show that in my class at Harvard, things are a lot better. Unfortunately, it was too late to do a pretest at the beginning of the semester. But, you know, I just wanted to show that my students were going to ace this force concept inventory. So one day, I walked into the classroom and I said to my student, look, we're going to have a quiz. I called it a quiz. I didn't want to call it a test because you know how pre-meds react when you say the word test. They freak out. So I thought, I'm going to give you a quiz and you don't have to worry about it. It's not going to affect your final grade in any way. It's just to measure the effectiveness of my own teaching. As soon as I said that, I thought, uh-oh, I've just taken away any incentive for them to take this test. You know, if you tell a pre-med this is not going to affect your final grade in any way, they don't even show up. So I thought, I better give them a reason to take this test seriously. So I said to them, look, we have a midterm coming up. If you take this test seriously, it will help you pinpoint any conceptual difficulties you may have, and you'll improve your performance on the midterm. As soon as I said that, I realized I told them a huge lie. I mean, the midterm dealt with rotational dynamics. They had to carry out triple integrals. I mean, it was so way beyond the force concept inventory that the two were totally disconnected. So I thought, I was worried, in fact, that my students would be offended when they would see the simplicity of this FCI. They would be mad for me wasting their time with something so trivial. Oh boy, were my worries quickly dispelled. Because hardly had the first group of students taken their seats in our computer classroom, or one student raised her hand and she said, Professor Mazur, how should I answer these questions? According to what you taught us? Or according to the way I usually think about these things? I had no idea how to answer that question. And by the time the test had been completed, I had been dragged out of my ivory tower. Before we get into the data and some things I did in response to discovering that my students didn't do that well, I want to talk briefly about our traditional approach to teaching. We heard about it already in the introductory remarks a little bit, but I want to come back to it. If you look at the architectures of most learning spaces, and I know, I mean, we have sort of a biased audience here because I know there are several people here representing very different approaches to learning, but by and large, everywhere around this globe, the architecture of the learning space dates back to the ancient Greek, and you see a scene not very different from the one you see on the screen there. The professor or the teacher, the instructor, in front of the room, students sitting in amphitheater seating, which has been developed with the sole purpose of focusing the attention of many onto one. I would like to ask you to give me a description, and I'll repeat it so that people online can hear it too, a description of the activity that is taking place on the screen there, preferably, you know, a short description using a verb, and I don't want that verb to be either teaching or learning. So speak out loud so I can hear it here, but give me a description of the activity that is taking place on the screen there. Watching, lecturing is an interesting word. The verb to lecture is derived from the Latin verb for to read. And in fact, in the UK, the lowest rank of one of the lower ranks of instructors in higher ed is called a reader. And that's actually very ironic. I'll tell you why that's very ironic. But, okay, both watching and learning describe only one half of the activity. The watching is the students in the front. The lecturing is the instructor in the back of that picture, depending on what you call front and back. I want something that describes the whole. I beg your pardon? Oblivious. Well, I mean, I hope I wasn't oblivious. That was actually me standing here. This is me. Again, that's just me. What about the whole? Me plus the students. Synergy. Well, we're getting closer. Broadcasting, I hear. I would have probably described it slightly differently. I would have said lectures focus on the delivery of information. In fact, I think Diana used that in her introductory remarks. So you fail to listen. Is it another proof that the lecture doesn't work, right? Anyway, you know what? The students had rubbed this in my face. Because when I started teaching, the first thing I did was go to a colleague who had taught a course before, and I asked him, what book do you use to teach this class? And he said, Halliday and Resnick. Those of you who've taken physics, even maybe 40 years ago, know that book because it's been a classic forever. So I went to the Harvard Coop in Harvard Square, and I ordered 150 copies of Halliday and Resnick because I was told to do so. And as I walked back from the Coop to my office, I thought, wait a minute. If all the students have the book, what do I do in class? Because, you know, I was educated in Europe, and in Europe, you would never get it into your mind to buy a book, because why would you buy a book for $150 or whatever it is if the instructor was going to read the book to you in class? So I went back to my colleague, and I said, if they all have the book, what do I do in class? And he said, oh, don't worry, there are plenty of different physics textbooks. And he showed me his whole collection of introductory physics textbooks on the shelf. So I looked around, and very quickly I found one book I really liked for two reasons. One, it had a slightly different approach to developing the physics. But the second reason was even much more important. It was out of print. The students couldn't get their hands on the book. So I used that book to prepare my lecture notes. And each class, I would have these notes from which I would either, you know, write portions on the blackboard behind me, or I would project them on the overhead using an overhead projector. And because the notes were different from the textbook, I decided I would give the students a copy of the lecture notes. So at the end of the class, at the doors in the back, there were piles of photocopies, and the students could just grab a copy of the notes I'd just lectured from. Why did I hand them out at the end of the lecture? What do you think? So they'd come. I didn't want them to come in, grab the notes, and go back to bed. But isn't that in retrospect, isn't that already admitting that there's a problem? Because why prevent the students from getting the information that way? There's some sort of ego trip, I guess. I just wanted them to come and listen to me. Anyway, I didn't realize any of that. Again, these were decisions I took unconsciously. However, after 6 weeks, some students came to me and they said, Professor Mazur, couldn't we get a copy of the lecture notes at the beginning of each class? This way we don't have to write down that much. And I indeed noticed that each time my chalk went A on the blackboard, 150 pens went A in the notebooks of the students. I once heard somebody describe the lecture as a process whereby the lecture notes of the instructor get transferred to the notebooks of the students without passing through the brains of either. Well, that was precisely what was happening in my classroom. So I decided to hand them in at the beginning of each class. And much to my relief, students didn't just grab the notes and walk away. No, they grabbed the notes, sat down, and they still copied everything because they had no time to read the notes. Anyway, the next year that I was teaching that same course, I said to myself, you know what, rather than handing out these lecture notes piecemeal, I'm going to give them, a week before classes, I'm going to have the whole collected set of lecture notes copied, and each student gets the full set for the entire semester on day one of the semester. You know what the unexpected result was? The unexpected result was that at the end of the semester, about half a dozen students wrote in their comment section at the bottom of the end of semester evaluation, Professor Mazur lectures straight from his lecture notes. Hello? I mean, what was I supposed to do? To develop another set of lecture notes to lecture from that was different from the lecture notes I handed out? I was livid. But you know, the students were right. I was focusing on the transfer of information. So that leads to the question, is that what education is? Is education merely the transmission of information? Who thinks that's correct? Can I see any hands up? Nobody raises their hands. So that means you all must know what is missing. Speak up. What is missing? If education is not information transfer, then what is missing? Two people have spoken at the same time, couldn't hear. Synthesis. That's right. You have to, as a learner, you have to do something with that information. You have to build mental models. You have to assimilate it. You have to be able to take that information and build a mental model so that you can use your knowledge in a new context, not simply parrot back the information at the instructor. Anyway, so I like to think now of education as a two-step process. One is information transfer. That is necessary, right? Without information transfer, there's no education. And secondly, that information needs to be assimilated. I would argue that the first part is easy, especially when we live in an information age, right? Information flows to us from everywhere. The second part, however, that's the hard work. And in the traditional approach to teaching, that second part is completely left to the student. Isn't that sort of ironic that we put all of our energy into the easy part and then leave to the student the hard part? So what I'd like to do in the remaining half hour or so is first of all tell you what I did in response to discovering that my students actually didn't learn very much in spite of my highly regarded lectures. And I call that approach peer instruction. Secondly, I'd like to try it out, involving, in addition to you here in this room, the people who are online. And we'll end by showing you some data, because I think it's very important to be scholarly about our approach to teaching, to have the same rigor, the same scholarship in education as we have in our various disciplines. I see my classroom as a laboratory, where I collect data. I don't collect data on the interaction of light and matter. No, I collect data on the interaction of ideas and words and students, on learning. So let's start with what to do in order to engender deeper learning. And if we think of the education as a two-step process, information transfer and assimilation, let's throw the information part out and use the synchronous part of education, there where we are in contact with the student, to help them better assimilate the information so that we as instructors can be there to help them with the harder part of learning. So as a result, what I do is I assign reading, which in the sciences is pretty much heresy in most courses, but there are a number of wonderful tricks, which I'm happy to discuss later, to actually make sure that the students read the material in a meaningful way. And then in class, I teach, although I should really avoid the word teach because it's all about learning, but I teach by questioning in order to have students learn the material. So I walk into class, I'll talk a little bit, I have a very brief presentation, and maybe I'll talk 5, 6, 7 minutes, and then I put a question, which I call a concept test. We'll try some out in just a minute, which I put on the screen. I poll them, either with these devices, which you all have in front of you, or right now we actually use only handheld devices. If more than 70% gets it correct, the question was too easy, I basically wrap up by explaining the question, and we repeat from the start with a harder question. If between 30 and 70% have it correct, I tell my students, talk to the people around you and find somebody who has a different answer, and then try to convince that person of your answer. Well, the first time I did that, it was really amazing, because I would always lecture, and I would stop, and I'd say, does anybody have a question? Anybody? If you wait long enough so that it gets completely painful, it's always the same person in the front row reluctantly raises his or her hand, but most of them do not get involved. The first time I told them to discuss something with their neighbor, and I saw a class of 150 students erupt in chaos, I just couldn't believe it. I'll show you a little video in just a second so you can see the activity. And what I found out was that in just a few minutes, students figured it out very rapidly, which surprised me, because I thought I was the teacher, so I should be the one who is able to explain it to them quickly. But imagine you have two students sitting next to each other, John and Mary. Mary has the right answer because she understands it. John does not. On average, I'm not saying this is always true, but on average, Mary is more likely to convince John than the other way around, simply because of the force of logic and reasoning. But this is the key point. Mary is more likely to convince John than Professor Mazur in front of the class. Why? Because Mary has only recently learned the material. She still knows what kind of conceptual difficulties a beginning learner has. She still has some feel for the trouble in John's head. Whereas Professor Mazur learned it such a long time ago, to him it's so clear that he has no clue what is going on in John's mind. It's sort of ironic. You'd say the more you advance in your discipline, the better qualified you are to teach. I'm in essence making an argument to the contrary. The more you're qualified, the more you advance in your discipline, the less qualified you are to teach, because you forget the difficulties of a beginning learner. And this interaction actually brings that back. Anyway, so between 30 and 70% get it correct, I tell them to talk to each other, and within a few minutes, most students figure it out. I poll again, wrap up. If less than 30% gets it correct, it doesn't make much sense to have them talk to one another, because they're simply not enough students getting the right answer. So I revisit the concept and then start over with an easier question. The ideal pathway is, of course, the highlighted one there. But that requires you to know what questions work best. Let me show you a very brief video clip, condensed, because the whole sequence really takes maybe 5 minutes. I'm only going to show you 1 minute of it, so you get a feel for the activity in the classroom. So I begin by reading. Could we have the audio up?
Field in the direction indicated by these arrows.
So I begin by reading the question is, with the students.
What are the magnetic forces on the four different sides of this loop? So take a minute to think about this and then enter your answers. Please enter your answers. We have a disagreement clearly here. Good. So turn to your neighbor and see if you can convince one another of the correct choice.
Right. It goes out of the top of his hand, so right. They cancel each other out.
There is a torque.
There is a torque.
How do you know that?
I said torque. What do you think? But it happens to be a torque.
Oh. Aha moment.
Initially, we had sort of an even split. And now we have an absolutely overwhelming majority for choice number two.
That aha moment is probably the most rewarding aspect of teaching that way. All these lights that go on in the eyes of the students when you see it from the front. Okay. Are you ready to try it? Did you all do your reading assignment? So, the people who are online can actually log in. Let me actually log back in here. And they can use the session ID ELI 2010. People who are here could do that too, but I don't know what the bandwidth is of the Wi-Fi in this hotel. We didn't really test it out, so I suggest that we use the plastic rather than the handheld devices. Although if you're extremely curious, you can go to rwpoll.com or use that QR code reader on the screen there. But anyway, let's use these plastic clickers. There's no on-off button. If you click one and then you think, oh no, it should be answer number two, that's fine, you click two, and that erases your previous one. The display will show you record an answer. Right now, if you press on the display, you see a small circle with a bar in it because I haven't opened the polling, so nothing happens. Turn for a moment to the back of the device. Oh, there's a card in the back of the device. Remove the card. Slide it down, and then you can put it back in. There's a barcode and a serial number. They all have a serial number, so in principle, you can track individual student responses if you're interested in seeing how individual students do. Okay, so let me show you what the software is from my perspective. I have this little thing that floats in front of my screen. If I press this button, the polling is open, so you're welcome to click a button now. And each time somebody clicks a button, the number of responses go up. And, you know, people at remote locations can also respond. At any time, I can click this display and see the distribution live. I'm sorry, you didn't get the right answer. I'm just kidding. There was no question. Okay, so let's all press one now, just to show you that you're very good at following directions. I just great audience. So you can see that the display is live, and it's only the last click that counts. Okay. So I'm glad Malcolm was able to give you my reading assignment and that you all read up on parabolic trajectories. I'm kidding. But we're going to talk about your favorite subject, namely parabolic or projectile trajectories. But since you didn't do your reading, why don't you take out one or two quarters out of your pocket? Okay? And let's first notice a few things about throwing things up in the air. Right? Take a coin and drop it. Right? Takes a certain amount of time. Now drop it from higher. Takes a longer amount of time. You find that the higher you release it from, the more time it takes. I mean, something that I guess most of us already grasp completely intuitively. Now here, try something else. Throw the coin up in the air. Don't hit your neighbors, okay? You'll get to interact with your neighbors later. That part comes afterwards. But throw it up in the air and observe the motion. And if you look carefully, you will observe that the time it takes to move up to the top and the time it takes to move from the top to the bottom are equal. You can actually prove that mathematically and you can reason through it, but I don't have time to do that. So apart from this sort of qualitative observation you have by throwing your quarter up, you will just have to take my word for it. But basically, the motion up is the inverse of the motion down, or the other way around, the motion down is the inverse of the motion up, right? It sort of slows down as it goes up, and it accelerates back up, speeds back up when it goes down. And that's all due to the pulling of the Earth. As it moves up, the Earth pulls it down, slowing it down. As it moves back down, it speeds up again because the Earth pulls it down. And those two motions are completely each other's inverse. In fact, this is really an interesting thing. If you make a movie of a ball thrown straight up and you play that movie backwards, you can't tell because it looks the same. So you can't tell what in which way time runs. Okay, so that's one thing you should know in order to answer the question I'm going to tell. The other one is that if you throw it not straight up, but I recommend you don't do that now, but you throw it, you know, sideways, so it has some sort of a parabolic trajectory like that, the vertical motion and the horizontal motion are decoupled. So in other words, it keeps moving at a steady velocity that way, but the up and down motion is completely decoupled from it. In fact, I'm going to show you a little video clip here that shows that. This is a card. I'm going to play it slowly here. Hang on. There. And let me stop it so I can go frame by frame. Here's on the left, first of all, you see a card that comes in with a magnetically suspended ball. When it passes this thing here, it triggers the magnet and the ball drops. Here, the ball is just triggered by somebody inserting a little card in a little trigger there. And you will notice that in spite of the fact that this ball moves sideways, the two balls fall at exactly the same rate, right? They fall at exactly the same rate. In other words, the fact that it moves sideways doesn't matter at all. Questions. And if you don't have questions, I have questions, okay? Yes. So here's the question. If I fire a rifle horizontally and I drop a quarter from the height of the muzzle of that rifle, do they hit the ground at the same time? Yes. It's absolutely amazing, but it's absolutely true. They will hit the ground at exactly the same time. In fact, you know, if you want, I don't want to take the time now because you probably already have forgotten that I'm here to talk about education. You're all so engaged. But we can do a little experiment later in the hall where I can show you that that's true. Okay. So, here's the question. You simultaneously throw two coins, and please don't do that here, it's going to be a mess, okay, with 400 people throwing two coins, I mean. If the coins follow the parabolic trajectory shown below, which coin hits the ground first? So I want you to take a minute to think about it, enter an answer. Oh, sorry, the answers are, let me tell you what the answers are. Yes. How can some of you start answering when there are no answer choices up on the screen yet? One for A, two, both at nearly the same time, B, first, and four, need more information. Okay, so please make up your mind. I'm going to give you another 10 seconds. And I want everybody to press a button. So if you don't know, if you're still hesitating between two and three or whatever, you just pick, but do commit yourself. Okay, I want that commitment from everybody here. And then the next step, you're going to find a neighbor who has a different answer. If everybody around you has the same answer, get up, find somebody who has a different answer. Go ahead. Turn to your neighbor and start discussing it with your neighbor. In the interest of time, please wrap up your discussion in the next 30 seconds and enter what you now believe to be the right answer. So, I mean, the great thing was, you saw how easy it is to fire up an audience this way. You got all engaged. And I'm sure you're not going to let me go without telling you what the right answer is. Even though this lecture is not about trajectories, it's about education. So you see the power of engagement here. I need all the answers in, though. I only have 160 people. So please click what you now believe to be. The same is true for the people online. Enter what you now believe to be the right answer. And if you somehow got disconnected online, go to rwpoll.com and enter ELI 2010. Ah, look at them. They're still arguing there at that table. Okay. So, are we ready? Initially, we had about 50% correct answers. And now we have, let's see how many, we have a spinning cursor of this there. We have still a split there and close to 50% right answer. Clearly people don't know if it's answer two or answer Answer three. Well, I know you're not going to, I don't want you to be awake in bed tonight and think, why is it, you know, number two and not number three? Remember this, the time each coin spends in the air is twice it takes the time to fall from a maximum height, right? The horizontal and the vertical motion are decoupled. So the only thing that matters is how high the coin goes. A coin that goes higher takes more time than a coin that goes low. So therefore, B hits the ground first. All right. Here's a little experiment you can do, but not now, okay? Because we got to talk about pedagogy, not about physics. But here's a little thing you can try out tonight in your room if you're still agonizing. You put two quarters on the edge of a table, like this. Okay, you put them on the edge of a table, and you flick them both off. I can't do it because this is not flat, but you flick them off, and one hard, the other soft. So one will go further away from the table, the other will go closer to the table. Observe when they hit the ground at exactly the same time. So the horizontal motion has nothing to do. Yes. Would you mind walking to a microphone so that everybody online? There's one right here in front. There's one, I think, right there.
I just wanted to ask about something that happened at our table, which is I chose B the first time, and then I got talked into, or I chose 3 the first time, and then got talked into 2. So I had the reverse. I was right, and then I became wrong. And that seems like a risk. Although I guess I engaged with the ideas more in our discussion, but does that happen in your class, and how do you deal with it?
Yeah, so what does that tell about your neighbors? In fact, let's see to what extent you're going to believe them on the next question.
That's fair.
The great thing about this is it's a self-correcting process, right? I mean, if you have somebody with a very overbearing personality who talks you into the wrong answer, you've learned something, right? To pay less attention to that person, and the other person went, oops, you know, I did the wrong thing. Again, we're here to talk about pedagogy, not about physics, so don't worry. It's not going to be on the exam. Let's try a very different type of question, and that has to do, again, with something that Diana mentioned earlier on, namely deep learning. I think in general, people agree there are two approaches to learning, you know, roughly speaking. One is a deep approach to learning, and the other is a surface or strategic approach to learning. For the student who uses a surface approach to learning, the main goal is to pass the examination. The deep learner, however, wants to make sense out of what he or she is learning. And I think studies have shown that surface learning in general leads to fragmented knowledge and therefore poor retention. There are no models to hold the knowledge in our heads. Whereas deep learning results in long-term retention and well-structured knowledge. So given that premise, let's consider 4 statements, and I want you to select the one that you think is the most accurate. For survey courses, a surface approach is more efficient. There's simply no time to delve into all the details. Or it's a trade-off. The deep approach provides conceptual understanding, but students also need a surface approach to memorize facts. Lastly, when students use a deep approach, they are more likely to remember details and learn problem solving. That was not lastly because there's a 4th choice. For each course, we need to determine for which parts of the content each of these 2 approaches is the most appropriate. So think about this, enter your answer, and then you'll get a chance to discuss it with your neighbor. 10 more seconds. Find a neighbor who has a different answer and start discussing it. Go ahead. Okay. I know I'm not giving you much time, but we have to move on. So why don't you indicate what you now believe to be the most accurate statement here. And initially we had a split between answer number 3 and 4 with a slight majority for 3, let's see what we have now. We have a bigger majority for 3. But the point I wanted to make with this question, which is of a different nature, are, one is you got engaged, you got as much engaged as in the other, even though there really is no correct answer. We could argue about this for a long time. In fact, you don't need to lose sleep over this. Right? But you got engaged, so that means that the type of questions we ask are not only questions that are true or false or have a correct or incorrect response. You know, and I'm sure that there are a lot of very interesting discussions that went on at the table. In fact, one of the tricks I use in my own class is that I occasionally ask individual students to articulate their reasoning and start a class-wide discussion, or, you know, where one student articulates one point and another student articulates another point. I want to do one more question, and then I'll wrap up in 5 minutes. This is a very different type of question, because I want you to experience, as a member in the audience, the feeling that these different types of questions generate. The first one, I'm sure you were very eager to get it correct. The second one is more a question of opinion. The third one is, again, a different type of question. Which of the following airlines tries to save fuel by suggesting that its passengers use the bathroom before boarding? And yes, these are, except for 9, these are all real airlines. So go ahead. No talking to your neighbor. You're a great crowd. You're very engaged, but I want individual commitment. No talking, I said. You did follow instructions quite well early on. Okay, so let's see what we have here. Now, the feeling, I'm sorry, most of you did not do right on this one. Now, the feeling you probably had was, one, this is crazy maybe, but secondly, how am I supposed to know this? If you had read Time Magazine or the Associated Press article, which was carried by a number of newspapers about a year and a half ago, November 2009, you've read an article that all Nippon Airways, which is the correct answer, here, these 14% can pat themselves on the back if they haven't guessed. All Nippon Airways is actually an airline that does that. But notice, this is a very different type of questions. Either you know it or you don't know it. Let's compare the three types. The two coins is a model about how projectiles work. I didn't give you much time. I mean, it was pulled out of context. But you can see how such a question can be used to build the correct mental model. The question about the learning approaches was a great discussion question. We could have gone on probably the entire hour, the entire afternoon, talking about surface versus deep learning. But the last question is just a fact. And it's not engaging. It doesn't give any engaging. You may remember for another few weeks that All Nippon Airways was the airlines, but I bet you that if I ask you a year from now which airline, you probably will have forgotten, unless you've flown All Nippon Airways and seen that in the boarding gate they actually ask you to go to the bathroom. So fact recall questions are simply not engaging. Unfortunately, many people have adopted the clicker as a tool to basically do fact recall, which I think does not do what we really want to do with them. It could be easily turned into an interesting question, because you could talk about the merits of having passengers go to the bathroom, right? And it could easily be constructed into a much more interesting question. But the way I had it posed, it was simply not a good question to engender deep learning. 5 minutes, the results. Here's the results for the FCI in 1990 when I taught a totally traditional class at the beginning of the semester. So this was before I had taught them. If you put a monkey behind a keyboard, he or she will score around 10 by just randomly pressing buttons, right? As you can see, some Harvard students belong in the primate section of the zoo. According to Hestenes, I wanted my students to be in the last three bins. When I took the test, I got 28 out of 29. I must have misread a question or something like that. I wanted my students to be in his last three bins. According to Hestenes, anybody who scores below 23, which is about two-thirds of my class at Harvard, has no good understanding of Newtonian mechanics. It's still partially an Aristotelian thinker. Well, but this is before I taught them. So let's see what one semester of award-winning teaching by yours truly does. There it is. And we still have some students who barely do better than random guessing. And you see the gain is minimal. At least there's a gain, but it's minimal. Now I'm going to show you what I've obtained with peer instruction. And much to my relief, the pretest is extremely stable from year to year. In fact, I've published an article about 10 years of testing, and it's been some of the most reproducible data I've ever obtained. What about the post-test? And this was the first year I implemented it. I was still groping in the dark because I didn't know what the right questions were, the optimum questions were. Here's the gain. It's significantly better. And I can assure you that I avoid teaching to the test. Although I was recently, not recently, in 1991 when I went to a meeting to report on these data, and I spent a precious four of my 8 minutes, I had to contribute a talk, nobody knew about me in education at that time, I spent four of my precious 8 minutes documenting that I had not taught to the test. And in the back somebody raised his hand and said, "Don't worry about teaching to the test. We've tried it. It doesn't work." But what about problem solving, right? I mean, after all, if you do all of these questions, how do students do on traditional exam problems? Well, I did something in 1991 which I'd never done before, namely repeat verbatim an old exam. And you know what? I thought if it stays the same, I'm happy. But they actually did better. Statistically significantly better. And we've definitely cut on the low-end tail. So what does that mean? That means that better understanding leads to better problem-solving, even if you do less of it in class. Because I'd done much less. In fact, I'd done no problem-solving in class. Right? I mean, you don't train for a marathon by sitting in front of the TV, eating popcorn, watching marathon runners. You've got to do the running. Same with problem solving. You got to do the problem solving. So I had the students do the problem solving outside of the class, not in class. The important point I want to perhaps leave you with is that good problem solving, if you take the inverse of this statement, good problem solving does not necessarily mean understanding. I had been fooling myself for many years into believing that I was a good teacher based on my students' problem solving ability. But all that they were doing is parroting back problems that they'd already learned to do before. So, in conclusion, I'm going to skip actually this little video of what students have to say of it. I'm going to, in the interest of time, because I want to leave a few minutes for discussion. In conclusion, I think active engagement greatly improves learning gains. There's plenty of data to back that up. And technology helps enable new modes of learning. And I want to emphasize what Diana said in her opening words. It's not just the technology. We could have done this without the clickers. I could have asked you to put your hand on your chest with the finger showing your choice. 1, 2, 3, and so forth. It would have been hard to see the people all the way in the back, but there are very few classes that are as large as this audience here. It's the pedagogy, ultimately, that matters. It's not just the technology per se. It's, in Diana's words, what we do with that technology. So if you're interested, here's a URL where there's more information on the work I did. You don't need to write it down. You know I hate note takers. Just go to Google, enter my last name, and then hit this I'm feeling lucky button, and then one more click and you'll have a copy of my presentation. Thank you for your attention.
You can find more podcasts like this by visiting www.educause.edu/podcasts. You can also search for EDUCAUSE on iTunes. Thanks for listening.